Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn how to move beyond diversity to true inclusion. Tomorrow, the Tulsa Area Human Resources Association and a host of community partners will present ideas and ways businesses' diversity and inclusion initiatives can foster creativity and innovation in the workplace, which can positively affect the bottom line. The 2014 Return on Inclusion Summit takes place at the downtown Doubletree and will lead HR professionals, executives, and community leaders to move beyond diversity rhetoric to strategies that will align with their business and organization objectives. My guest today is diversity consultant Lenora Billings-Harris, who will be the leader for the summit. She's consulted for a wide range of top businesses and brands, nonprofit organizations, and governmental organizations. She's the author of two books, The Diversity Advantage, A Guide to Making Diversity Work, and Trailblazers, How Top Business Leaders Are Accelerating Results Through Inclusion and Diversity. She's an adjunct professor in business at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and she'll be the leader for the Return on Diversity Summit tomorrow, a half-day event from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Lenora Billings-Harris, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You'll be leading a Return on Diversity Summit tomorrow here in Tulsa. And let's talk about how businesses can actually get a return on diversity. Diversity has always been couched traditionally as the right thing to do, to look like America. But is there a competitive advantage?
Oh, my goodness, absolutely. It used to be several years ago when I started this work in the space of diversity and inclusion that those of us that did it would talk anecdotally about the return on investment. Now, in 2014, there have been so many studies that absolutely prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that when organizations are diverse, but more importantly, are diverse and inclusive, that they actually have a better bottom line, their retention is better, their innovation is higher. There's just, you know, in many different directions you can go, customer service, etc. The challenge is oftentimes businesses will embark upon creating a more diverse environment without thinking about how to make it inclusive. So just bringing people in who are different is not enough. You need to bring people in who are different and then create that culture that values diversity of thought. And that's what ultimately brings about a better bottom line.
And that's really the difficult part, because I can speak from a vantage point of educational institutions. Educational institutions have been diversifying their student bodies for a long time. But when you walk through the halls, you see groups of African-American students, Hispanic students, Asian students, white students, but all separate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the famous analogy, if you go to any school from elementary through college, you go to the lunchroom and you will see clumps of various groups self-segregating.
Yes.
How do you break that down in a business environment?
Well, it does.
Obviously it has to start from the top, doesn't it?
Well, it does start from the top, and having that happen is not all negative. In fact, there was a book written about why do all the black kids sit together in a cafeteria. Mm-hmm. People who are alike want to be with other people who are alike. However, when the people who are different happen to be people of color, because it's easy to see, then we notice that they're sitting together. No one ever says, well, why do all the white kids sit together? Because you don't think about that. However, it is not negative necessarily in the business environment. So going back to your question, in the business environment, many organizations create opportunities for people who are similar in some way, either women or Latino or African American, or there's many different categories, where they will create what are called business resource groups so that they can get together, but not just get together to commiserate or to just hang out. Rather, they get together to learn from each other, to mentor one another, to help know that they're not the only ones, and they have a business focus. So, for instance, some organizations will have a business resource group that they go to when they're developing a product to say, help us have better ideas on how to market this.
They're an internal focus group.
Exactly, exactly. And so that's how it, again, goes back to that ROI. But we need to recognize that people will always want to be around other people just like them. In the school environment, on the high school level, there, I I can't remember the name that they actually give it, but there's one day a year across the country in the U.S. where students will celebrate not sitting with people just like them. They intentionally reach out to others so they can meet people that are not like them. And when organizations do those kinds of things, when they sponsor them, when the leaders say this is a good idea, then people become less afraid to reach out to people that they don't know very well or who are very different than them.
So what are the first steps to taking a diverse organization and making it a diverse, inclusive mm-hmm. organization?
Most times organizations think the first thing we need to do is recruit at university level as well as right, in the right. business environment. Let's go recruit people who are different. In my opinion, absolutely the wrong first step. First step is let's create a culture of inclusion. Let's start talking about all the ways that we are different, not just by ethnicity, but to help the workplace environment, help the people there realize that I may be different because I'm from the Northeast. I now live in the South, for instance, and so that would be a difference. Or maybe you speak three languages and I only speak one. My point is to help people to recognize that diversity is not a bad thing. It's just different. So you start with those conversations, maybe with training, with brown bag lunch kinds of things, book reading, whatever. There's lots of different ways to do it, where you begin to create that environment where people are more open to folks who are different than them. Then you start the recruiting process. And one quick suggestion that I always share with my clients is when you start the recruiting, if you keep looking in the same place you've always been looking, of course, you're not going to find much diversity. So when you start to branch out to other places, and now you have that short slate of the people that will be interviewed, if there's only one person who's diverse, and diverse, you know, all of us really are diverse, but for our conversation here, let's say it's one person who is ethnically different. If you only have one person on that slate of 10 people to be interviewed, you haven't looked hard enough. Because when they start interviewing, the interviewers will only see that difference. They won't see the real person. Two is not enough either, because they'll compare the two. So you need to have, if it's 10 people, you need to have at least three people who are different. And maybe they're not all different ethnically. One could be an African-American. Another person might be someone with a disability, and someone could have some
Native
other
American,
kind of difference.
Asian.
Exactly.
Right, right.
But when the interviewers look at that many people who are different in lots of ways, then they'll start seeing the individuals and what skills and abilities and talents they actually bring rather than comparing them.
Let me ask you about highly technical trades, say engineering or graduate degree level entry, you know, where you're moving into the world. A lot of times those are very professional, and probably some of the places a recruiter is going to go might be, by a vast majority, mainly white. Mm-hmm. What does the recruiter have to do to get that diversity? That sounds like you have to widen your sphere.
Exactly. And here again, especially with something like engineering, we certainly hear the studies.
You probably hear this a lot, that there's just not qualified candidates. Well, and you're just not going to the right place, right?
We just can't find any, right.
Yeah.
And, but the problem is that they're not looking, because there are several HBCUs, historically black universities and colleges, who have extraordinary engineering programs, where they partner with NASA, where they partner with bioengineering. I mean, just amazing things that are being done now. Two schools come to mind immediately in the Southeast. But yet again, if you're not looking, you don't find them. And so, number one, you have to go to different places. And here again, from a recruiting perspective, whether you're looking for engineers or you know, other people that may not need to have that level of training, is ask yourself, what is the criteria for what equals qualified? Because here's what happens. People will list, here's the skills that the person needs to have. And certainly if they have to have a PhD in engineering, then fine. There are people of color who have those. Not a whole lot of them. They're out there. That might be one thing. But if you're really serious about diversifying your workplace, then diversity needs to be listed as one of the skills, talents, or understandings that's equally weighted to the other things that are important. So let's take it away from an engineering degree for a moment. Let's say you're looking for someone in finance. Maybe they have to have their CPA. Well, in addition to having the CPA, there's probably some other skills that you need. And if you're wanting to diversify your firm, then maybe one of the skills is they have to be sensitive to diversity. Because you don't, just being black, for instance, doesn't mean that you're sensitive. So let's be clear about that, that there are bigots and racists in every form and fashion. However, what tends to happen is diversity is put on the list as something that's very important until they start interviewing. And then it becomes a nice to have, not a need to have, because they didn't ahead of time have a discussion about how important it is, and then rate people based on their diversity sensitivity. Because that changes even the questions that you ask. Don't assume that a person of color or a woman has any higher level of sensitivity around some diversity issues than others. There are many white men who are highly sensitive to valuing diversity and know how to create that inclusive environment. So you begin to identify different questions, and all of these things need to happen before you ever you have the candidate in front of you.
Or before you have the opening, or exactly. As you're approaching the opening.
Exactly. And that's where I find most organizations get in trouble, because they don't do that. Then they bring someone in who might happen to be diverse, but they didn't do any of the homework. And then there's a revolving door. And they say, well, see, we hired one and they left. Well, you didn't have the environment to keep them there in the first place.
And really those discussions, I would assume, would make for a lot of discussions that lead to how do we make sure that we actually include this person in our workplace?
Mm-hmm.
You have to have these discussions within your workplace well before you continue to diversify.
You have to do that, and there are many different ways to do it. My business partner, as it relates to webcasts, she and I launched a whole series of webinars this year. She's an expert in change. And so we identified, you know, what are the skills that are really nitty-gritty, I mean, really get to the one-on-one, that people can apply immediately, and how then can we share that through webinars, because they're so inexpensive compared to sending a person off to a workshop and that kind of thing. And one of the things that comes up often is, so now you have this diverse team. As a leader, what am I supposed to do different? Well, if you have a low number of women on your team, then you need to educate yourself about gender communication, because generally speaking, I'm not stereotyping all men, but generally speaking, men will tend to interrupt women, and men's voices will be heard, or a woman will share an idea, and then a guy says essentially the same idea. Nobody heard the woman, but then when the guy says it, it's the best thing since sliced bread. So as a leader, you need to know that ahead of time so that you could then say, oh, John, I'm so glad that you liked Maria's idea.
Right.
To bring
that you
her
agree
back
with,
in.
Yeah, you agree,
exactly.
Yeah, right.
And it's those types of little things called micro messages that either positively, that send message positively to the person who's different that says you matter, or when they're negative micro messages, it says you don't count. And those are the things that we all need to learn.
My guest today is Lenora Billings-Harris, a diversity consultant, adjunct professor at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. And she'll be the leader for the Return on Diversity Summit, which takes place tomorrow at the downtown Doubletree. It's a half-day event from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m., looking at what the actual return on diversity is. One of the things I've seen is here at the University of Tulsa campus, we've had a great effort over the last 20 years, 15 years to diversify the student body. And as I mentioned, just in the last couple of years, I've seen those cafeteria moments sort of break down.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's happening? Is that a larger trend in our society? Because I'm seeing it reflected in advertising and television where multiracial interaction is being shown as a positive mm-hmm. thing, and especially in advertising, which I always used to think advertising is like you're going to go for a Hispanic audience or an African American audience or a white audience. Now you see this sort of trend. Is this a wider trend that we're seeing? Is it backed up by research at all?
Yes, it is. And certainly there is a trend in that direction. And most people in media say they don't make the news or they don't make the trends, but they're reporting on them in one way or another, or they're reflecting them. Mm-hmm. And TV shows and sometimes movies, and then also in advertising, they usually are just a little bit ahead of most of society. However, what we're finding is that because the millennials, which you know is larger than the baby boomer population, because it is said, it's a myth, this is not actually true, but it's said, oh, the millennials don't notice diversity. That's not true. The millennials do notice diversity, but they don't see it as a problem. They do notice if it's missing. So back to advertising, millennials, who are now your college students and some are in the workplace already, they will notice if there's not a mixture because they've grown up with seeing it in one way or another, but they haven't necessarily grown up, depending on where they're from and their parents' values and all of that, they haven't necessarily grown up learning that difference is bad. So we're now seeing more a reflection of the millennials' values, and so the folks that react to it negatively, usually, not always, but usually are older. And they'll be, oh my gosh, you know, like with the Cheerios commercial, and they'll start tweeting about it and all kinds of things, where the millennials are saying, what's the big deal?
This shows an interracial relationship.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes. So the millennials do say, you know, what's the big deal? Because they don't see it as a negative.
Right. Well, is there another issue involved where I refer to it as the Day of Jubilee, and that's from a political commentator who was commenting on the striking down of the voting rights, that there's no more racism, There's no more, you know, is there also that reaction? You know, you have black president of the United States, there's a thriving black middle class, there's you know, Hispanics are moving up, you know, we're all one big happy family, we don't need to think about this anymore. Is there certainly a current within American thought that goes this way?
Well, I think there is, but it's erroneous, in my opinion. I think we would like to think we are post-racism, but particularly on race as opposed to some of the other diversities, because of our history and because there still are many people alive right here in Tulsa, who have experienced the negative aspects, well, there's no positive aspects of racism, who've experienced racism, that to say because we have a black president that racism is past.
Or because of any single factor.
Or any single factor, right. No. Because, you know, as proud as all of us, I hope, are that the United States has finally elected an African-American president, he is not the norm. And so when we look at our everyday lives and we look at African-American men, they are not all President Obama. And because I'm sure you know and the listeners pay attention to the news and what happens in certain towns with police. And actually, I have three different clients now that are police departments in small towns that are hoping that some of these things don't happen if they do the right things up front. But my point is that what we want to believe is that racism is those people, mm-hmm. instead of recognizing that if we are born on this planet, all of us have bias. We cannot avoid it. However, we can become more conscious of our own biases, we can choose to become more aware so that we do not act on those negative biases. So when we see certain things in the news or experience certain things, and there's diversity collisions, what I call diversity collisions, all over, all around, all the time. And I was on a Skype call this morning with a colleague, and she was just explaining to me what just happened to her yesterday. My colleague is white. And she said, I was just so appalled at what this woman said to me. And she, you know, she said, I'd like to believe this doesn't happen anymore. And it was a white woman who made a comment to her, mm-hmm. assuming that my colleague thought the way she did,
yeah, right.
when it came to race. And, it's, you know, it's alive and well. But we can choose to not be silent. We can choose to not, you know, not get in somebody else's face, but find the ways, either using humor or something, that helps us say, that's not okay. that's what begins to change the needle. Not having one person who is very visible be in a position and then, you know, all of a sudden then we don't have racism anymore, we don't have sexism anymore. It's still there.
Yeah. I was just thinking about your comment on bias. It's just, you know, bias is a healthy thing. Mm-hmm. If you're walking down a dark street and there is a large fellow that looks like he might have a gun under his belt and looking evilly at you, that's a healthy bias.
Well,
now, if it is a black person or a Hispanic person who's just minding his own business, mm-hmm. that's an irrational bias. And crossing to the other side of the street is probably not the best question.
Well, and what I would say to that, because my partner who I just referred to a moment ago for webinars, Chris Clark Epstein, her son happens to be a police officer. And so we have these lively conversations, not debates actually, but very lively conversations about issues like that. And what her son said, and he teaches also, and what he said was the research bears out that the people that get attacked are the people that look like victims ahead of time. And so when you're, number one, you shouldn't be walking down a dark alley at night. You know, that would be, don't do things that are unsafe to begin with. But if you're walking down the street and then you see someone who's walking towards you, if you pay attention to them, if you give them eye contact, you've already given them the clue that I'm paying attention. And interestingly enough, just before she had shared that with me, that piece of research and what he teaches his student, his police academy students, I had had a very similar event happen. I'm originally from New Jersey, and I was staying with my dad, and I went to take out the trash, and it was dark. And my dad had happened to mention earlier in the day that there are more black people moving in the neighborhood. And he was pleased about that he was seeing more black kids playing with the white kids, that kind of thing. So I'm taking out the trash, and then I see this guy coming from between two buildings, sort of like an alley. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in an alley, but I could see him. He was walking in my direction. And my first instinct was to be safe. And I could see that he was a person of color, and he had on a hoodie. So all the stereotypical images.
Yeah, all these negative biases are coming in. Yeah.
And so I thought, I am going to make sure I help him know that I am not your typical woman responding in a stereotypical way. So when he got a little bit closer, I said, good evening, and how are you? So I gave him eye contact, and I spoke. And he was a good distance away, but he could hear me. And then I emptied the trash. He went on and did what he did. And so when I shared this with my business partner a couple of days later, that's when she told me about the research and the fact that I had given him good eye contact and all of that. But here's my point. How many of us don't connect to the bias or the stereotype that comes up in our head? We just react. And where we begin to move the needle is to connect with what's coming up in ahead. Because if there was anything about him that said, this is unsafe, then I needed to react in a way that would keep me in safety. There was nothing about him that said I would be in an unsafe situation. Plus, he was far enough away. And so I could do the opposite, give him a positive micro message instead of a negative one.
My guest today is Lenora Billings-Harris, a diversity consultant who will be leading the Return on Diversity Summit, which takes place tomorrow at the downtown DoubleTree. It's a half-day event. She's the author of The Diversity Advantage, A Guide to Making Diversity Work, and Trailblazers, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, getting back to the title of this, The Return on Diversity, can you give us maybe a case study of a company that really made an inclusive atmosphere, and they saw a difference in their bottom line?
Absolutely. One that my co-author and I wrote about in our Trailblazers book, the beginning of that book, we highlighted 12 chief diversity officers. We knew they didn't have time to write their own stories. And so we did that in the first chapter. In any case, with one company, and I'm sure they won't mind me mentioning them, it's Merck, which is a pharmaceutical company. They are a global organization. And they have an Asian women's business resource group. They had created a particular drug that would help the Asian female population in particular, you know, in particular. And they went to that business resource group before they started marketing it to say, help us put together a marketing strategy, knowing that the Asian culture in general does not talk about intimate things out loud. And their concern was this drug can really cure whatever the disease was or whatever the ailment was. And it was critical that they know about it. How could we do it in a way that they would pay attention?
But it was involving a sensitive...
Yes, very sensitive.
Culturally sensitive subject in which you didn't talk about in polite company. Yeah.
So the group got together. They created a task force because the people in the business resource group came from all parts of the company. And they created a commercial that would be well received. They created a song. They created collateral material along with the marketing department. And the drug went far beyond any of the bottom line expectations in that particular market. And there are those kinds of stories that happen over and over with IBM, who has been known for its sensitivity to diversity and inclusion and really truly being a trailblazer way out there before many other companies. They have as part of their professional development where their employees can choose what community organization they may want to work with and it would be part of their diversity development as long as it relates to the company's goals. And one of the company's goals, because of course it's all about computing and technology and that type of thing, is when you work with that organization, you want to be helping the people you're serving to connect with using computers, understanding programming, all of that type of thing. So they connect the diversity development to their business goals. When they do that, that says to that diverse community, whatever the community is, that a company's not just coming in and throwing money at us, but they really care about our community. And then that people in those communities go out and buy the products. So it's a cyclical effect, and you have to track it. You know, so they create systems in place so that they can track that.
That sounds like a far better return on the bottom line than all of a sudden hiring an ad company to go out and market your product, which has traditionally been lily white, to say a Hispanic audience or an Asian audience or an African American audience. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a far better strategy.
And you're doing two things at once. You are impacting the bottom line in a positive way, you are also developing leaders. You're developing leaders who will have a sensitivity to diverse audiences or to diverse groups that they might not have otherwise.
Yeah. Well, we hope a lot of people come out for this Return on Diversity Summit. Lenora Billings-Harris, thanks very much for joining us.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you, Rich.
Diversity consultant Lenora Billings-Harris speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She'll be the leader for the Return on Diversity Summit, which takes place tomorrow at the downtown Doubletree. It's a half-day event from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. To learn more about it, visit roiok.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.